Thank you. Be seated. Good morning. This morning, the court has four copies on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Exxon Corporation versus West Texas Gathering Company and others from Winkler County. National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania versus the Ninth Court of Appeals on original mandamus proceeding. National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania versus the Honorable Rogelio Valdez, Judge, on original mandamus proceeding. And River Center Associates versus the Honorable Raul Rivera, Judge, on original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, time has been allotted by the court, and the counsel have been advised of that time. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of its time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete these arguments before our lunch break. These arguments are being recorded by tape for the convenience of the court. If anyone desires to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Exxon versus West Texas Gathering.
Please the court. Mr. Shannon Ratliff will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Shannon Ratliff. I represent the petitioner in this case, Exxon Corporation, in an appeal from a judgment of the El Paso Court of Appeals. That judgment stripped Exxon of a $22 million jury verdict after a two-week trial in Winkler County, Texas, and deprived Exxon of a judgment with prejudgment interest of $27 million. The Court of Appeals reversed and rendered a take-nothing judgment against Exxon, adopting a contract interpretation as a matter of law, which it admitted in its opinion, allowed the purchaser of gas, West Texas Gathering Company, to drive down the allowables and to avoid contract liability, despite the fact that the contract was silent on a critical term and that Exxon's its alternative interpretation was reasonable, and it promoted the purposes and the intent of the contract. The Court of Appeals also reversed and rendered because it held it after striking Exxon's expert witness, who had been fully identified in interrogatory answers and who had testified as to his methodology more than 60 days before trial. After striking that testimony, they held there was no evidence to support the damage award in favor of Exxon Corporation. It also reversed and rendered on the basis that the broad form submission was erroneous because Exxon had not sought an explanatory instruction in connection with that issue, contrary to the express terms of Rule 278. West Texas Gathering Company sought no instruction with regard to what it now contends was the proper interpretation of the contract as a matter of law, and instead submitted some six pages of instruction out of the what has become known as the Lively case, another take-or-pay case, most of which quoted contract language not present in the contract involved in this case. The facts in this case are that Exxon Corporation was a seller of gas from the Emperor Field in Winkler County, Texas, under a gas purchase contract. That original contract was entered into in 1958 between Humble Oil and Refining Company and West Texas Gathering Company. Replacement contracts between Exxon and West Texas Gathering involved in this case were made in 1977 and rolled over or extended in 1983. I'd like to direct the court's attention, if I might, to the chart at my left, which is a summary of West Texas' performance under this contract over the years involved in this case. The information contained on this chart comes from Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 19 admitted in the trial of the case. And if I might approach the chart, Ron, the first, the top line, the aqua line, is committed gas available. That represents annually what Exxon had committed 100% of the gas from the properties dedicated. Based on deliverability test, that amounted to about 8.5 billion cubic feet a year. It could not sell that gas to anyone other than West Texas Gathering Company. It held this gas in readiness to perform under its contract with West Texas Gathering Company. The second purple line indicates what is called the 80% baseline take or pay. In the contract in Section 1, which I'll be discussing with you a little bit later, all the parties agree that Section 1 sets the baseline quantity for both the amount of gas which West Texas would take or the amount of gas for which it would pay. And that amount is 80% of the gas available. The third line in yellow, referred to as Rhodes calculation, is the calculation by Mr. Donnie Rhodes, Exxon's expert, and an expert in Railroad Commission gas allocation matters, of the recalculated allowable under paragraph 2 of section 4 of the quantities provision, which we will be discussing. As you will know, contrary to what the Court of Appeals in El Paso said, his calculation is not simply another, he doesn't simply go back and recreate 80%. And the reasons for those differences are reasons based on the way the allowable system operates when you recalculate the hypothetical allowable, and on his having given credit to West Texas Gathering Company for periods of time during which Exxon did not have gas available because of compressor failures, pipeline breaks, and other force majeure conditions in the field. The red line on the bottom indicates West Texas performance in terms of its actual takes or purchases of gas. And as you can see, it never took 50% or it never took even half of the gas that was available and committed. And as a matter of fact, in 86, 87, and 88, it is running along on minimal quantities. Based on this level of performance, West Texas claims and claimed in the trial court that it owed Exxon absolutely nothing under the contract.
Mr. Ratliff, you complain under the Court of Appeals opinion that West Texas could manipulate this clause if, in fact, it was predicated on actual takes rather than its hypothetical.
That's correct.
Take. Yet, doesn't the allowable granted by the Railroad Commission depend on nominations based on actual takes?
The allowable system before the Railroad Commission relies on nominations and actual takes. And you're right, Your Honor, but one of the things I think that we need to point to here is that under the Railroad Commission system, when I make a nomination as a purchaser, that is the nomination of my expected gas demand in the following month. And I swear on that form that that is the amount of gas which I expect to take and use in the following month. And the Railroad Commission tracks very carefully whether your takes and nominations tend to remain at least in reasonable proximity to each other. There will be variances, and we can see that. But the problem we've got is that what West Texas Gathering Company is saying in this case is because, and if I might, Your Honor, let me remove this so I can refer to some of the contract language. Because the first paragraph of Section 1 talks about what the Railroad Commission does, West Texas Gathering Company is able to nominate 80% in any year. That means that if they have a market and are able to nominate that 80%, then this is the way that the Railroad, that they say, that this says, this is the way the Railroad Commission will determine it. And then
the amount that they have to pay for paperwork becomes the lesser of the allowable volumes allocated by the commission to seller's property, or the minimum daily quantities in section one, which is 80%. Now, what they're saying, and what the El Paso court bought, was that the language, the amount so allocated to the property, inferred or implied the use of actual takes, and therefore you were required to use that same inference or implication in paragraph two.
You do agree, though, that the take, even under your hypothetical take calculation, which you urge, that is based at least in part on actual takes by West Texas, because that's how the Railroad Commission calculates its allowable.
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. That's West Texas Gathering Company's position, and it is our position that if you, that under paragraph 2 of section 4, you not only must assume 80% nomination or 80% market demand, you must also assume takes consistent with that nomination. And I will submit to you that we are in a situation in which the witnesses who compiled this language said this language was in there to protect the producer against the purchaser driving down the allowable by virtue of what they did at the commission.
Just so I understand, one last question on this. So your contention is that in no way does the take-or-pay obligation depend on actual takes, either on the front end or on the tail end?
Well, let me make sure I'm clear. It would not be a factor in the entry, in the calculation under paragraph 2. Obviously, to the extent they take gas, they don't owe us to pay for that again. It is the actual takes are subtracted from the amount computed under paragraph 2.
But do actual takes go into the allowable granted by the Railroad Commission?
Yes, sir.
Okay. At least to that extent, actual takes are a factor in their liability under this contract.
If I'm understanding, and I hope I am.
Well, I don't understand all this, but I'm asking for your help.
I'm sorry, I'm understanding. Let me go back. Paragraph 1 of section 14 basically says what is going to happen if they nominate 80%, and therefore the commission sets an allowable quantity to the property. What they are saying to you is that this language is so clear in this section that you are dealing with actual tax, because that's what the Railroad Commission would do in setting allowable quantity. That you are required to make that same assumption down in paragraph 2, where you are dealing with a hypothetical, a what-if situation.
It seems, at least in the abstract, that your position with respect to the second paragraph, apart from any system problems and ways in which the allowable system works, would result in simply an 8% take.
I think that's a good point, and one I'd like to explain.
Why does your interpretation vary from that?
If you will notice, Your Honor, on this chart, the yellow line, as I pointed out, does not track 80%. And why is that? The reason for that is that language was included in the contract in order to say to West Texas Gathering Company, if you do all that you can, if your market equals 80% and you nominate that amount, you are still going to get the benefit of a reduction in allowables if that is brought about by the nominating and taking practices of other producers in the field. You're still going to, because, let me back up if I might, Justice Hatfield.
I'm sure you know this, but the fact of the matter is in determining market demand for gas, the Railroad Commission first decides what the statewide market demand is for natural gas on the basis of all of the nominations for natural gas in a given month. It then allocates that production back to pools or feeds on the basis of the nominations from the particular purchasers in that area and the availability of gas. In taking into account what is allocated to that field, you would not simply look at West Texas Gathering Company, although it was a very dominant purchaser in this field. You would look at the other purchasers in the field. And the idea, as explained by Mr. Sledge in the testimony in the trial in this case, the idea was that West Texas did all it could to comply with the contract, it was not going to be penalized for the actions of other purchasers.
And so, in fact, however, there was little variance between the 80% and your contention of the way paragraph 2 operates.
That is correct, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because of West Texas Gathering predominant position in the Emperor field.
And it would have been extraordinary circumstances where it would have reduced where paragraph 2 would have reduced that below the 80%.
Extraordinary circumstances in
statewide lowering in the demand for gas.
Well, and also I think it would have taken other purchasers, would have had to have impacted the allowable more than they did in the calculation. But I think it's important to point out to the court that what they're saying is, what West Texas Gathering Company is saying is that actual takes are compelled in paragraph 2, even though their expert witness, Mr. Foy, had to admit in the trial of this case that the word actual takes is never used in either paragraph 1 or paragraph 2, and that it must be implied or inferred from the language the allowable volumes of gas so allocated to seller's properties, because he said the Railroad Commission, that's the way they would do it. They would look at actual takes. Well, I would also point out, as the court well knows, that language is totally absent in paragraph 2. And certainly, at least in normal contract interpretation terms, that would mean that the absence of that language in paragraph 2 is certainly at least equally consistent with the idea that you're going to use something different. I also think it's important to go back to Mr. Sledge, who was the author of this language. And what Mr. Sledge said, he was an employee of El Paso, not an employee of ours, not an employee of West Texas. What he said about this language, when asked specifically about it, is he said, we're going to recalculate the allowable as though we had nominated and purchased it in accordance with paragraph 1. And when he was questioned by West Texas Council, saying, do you mean taken or do you mean nominated? And he said, no, they're one and the same to me. Because they're one and the same to people who know the Railroad Commission and know that when you talk nominations, you're talking expected takes. And that those, while they're not going to be identical, are going to lay down in a way that is very similar.
Mr. Ratliff, since your time's about up, ask you to focus your attention on what most of the Court of Appeals opinion was about with reference to Mr. Rhodes.
Yes, sir.
Isn't this a situation where, as a part of its trial strategy, El Paso chose to have its expert witness defer the basis for his trial testimony to calculate it up until the eve of trial?
You used El Paso. You mean Exxon, Your Honor?
Exxon.
No, sir, that is not true. And the reason it is not true is that if that had been the strategy, we would not have had Mr. Rhodes disclosing in his deposition in September on more than four occasions the methodology he would use in making the calculation under paragraph 2 of section 4. And the fact of the matter is, it's uncontroverted in this record that he was instructed to proceed to do the study under paragraph 2 of section 4 in early October, and that it was delivered to the defendants in this case as soon as it was completed.
But not as Rule 166B6B would seem to contemplate 30 days in advance of trial.
Your Honor, I disagree with that, because I think there's another rule that says how you go about requiring a written report and requiring it a reasonable period before time, as this court has written. And the fact of the matter is that the defendants in this case did not seek to do that. I also believe it's significant to point out to you, they delivered their expert report to us on October the 23rd. So it was not, this was not a conscious stratagem. This was a situation in which, after 4 days of examination by four different lawyers, it was determined that this calculation should be made, which requires the recreation of the whole allowable system as it applies to the emperor feeder.
Without that calculation, you'd have no basis for your judgment, would you?
No, sir, I disagree with that. The invoices were admitted into evidence offered by both, two of the invoices offered by the defendants. The remaining invoices offered by us with no objection.
That's about only $3 million, right?
No, sir. That's about $22 million, as I recall.
How is it that you complied with the requirements of 166B6B concerning conveying the substance of his testimony?
We complied with it, I think, in two ways, Your Honor. First of all, and I'm not as conversant with all the subdivisions, but first of all, there was nothing misleading about our answer to interrogatories. We told them that if he could do this calculation, he would do it, that he might do it, and we also told him that if he did it, we might present it at trial. So I don't think we misled them, first of all, and secondly, they were fully aware from September what his methodology was, and they were supplied the report as soon as it was ready.
There is a reference in your application for writ of error to the deposition of Mr. Tim Vick.
Yes, sir.
That he testified that Mr. Rhodes was going to recalculate the damages under Method 3.
On October 9th.
Is that the deposition a part of the record in this case?
The deposition is not a part of the record, but I found that in the transcript yesterday, Your Honor, and I can supply that transcript reference.
Would you afterwards?
I said
and then let me just ask you one other question, and that is about your understanding of the Court of Appeals holding reference to the points of error concerning the whether this was all excused by government regulation.
Well, Your Honor, I think that any fair reading of the Court of Appeals opinion says that they sustained points of error 5 and 19. To the extent they were no evidence points, and if the court will recall, that immediately followed, having ruled that Rhodes' testimony was improperly admitted, and there being no other evidence of damage to Exxon, then to the extent that they are no evidence points. I think it's significant that the court's opinion never discusses paragraph 3. It never discusses the force majeure clause. It never discusses the governmental regulation clause. And it never comments on it. And it never even notes the fact that the jury, there was an adverse finding on governmental regulation and force majeure by the jury, because the jury was instructed in connection with question 2 to subtract from any amounts that they found due and owing. Amounts that were not available, that were the subject of force majeure or governmental regulation. So I would simply say that I don't believe that. I think a fair reading of the Court of Appeals opinion was, is it was grouped as a no evidence point based on the objection to Rhodes' testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please the court? Mr. Donald Hunt will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, I'm Don Hunt, appearing today on behalf of all of the respondent defendants, West Texas Gathering, Cabot Corporation, and the Mesa Companies. In contrast to the seeming web of inequity woven by Exxon, a number of just bases exist on which the judgment should be affirmed. These include a correct construction of the contracts, waiver of any claim of ambiguity, and discovery abuse. To place these just bases, however, in proper perspective, the case must be refocused.
Before you refocus it, sir, could you address the last question that I asked Mr. Ratliff? Isn't he right about that, though you argue in your brief that this government regulation clause is really a CA, a Court of Appeals holding that that they've not brought before this court? Wasn't their writing, to the extent they wrote it all, directed solely toward damages?
Your Honor, the opinion can be read in many different ways, but what Exxon omits is any reference to Rule 90. Rule 90 explains that when a losing party believes the language of the opinion is less than sufficient, then it has a right to focus a point of error in the motion for rehearing and the application explaining that the Court of Appeals did not write as Rule 90 requires. What Exxon cannot escape on that governmental regulations defense is that the Court of Appeals language expressly sustained two points of error that dealt with liability based on no evidence.
How is it any different than if they had a typographical error in their opinion?
Your Honor.
On the number, and they put in point of error 6, and it should have been point of error 5.
It's not, but that's a problem that Exxon must face. If the court expressly sustains a point of error it doesn't intend to sustain, it's a sustaining. Consider the position, Your Honor, of the respondents in this case. Respondents couldn't complain of the sustaining of a point of error. All that could be done is to argue as a reply point that the Court of Appeals had affirmatively ruled in favor of the respondents by sustaining no evidence points of error on liability. And if that's an error by the Court of Appeals, then Exxon should have addressed that in Rule 90, should have pointed it out. But that's a defense out that deals with one reason why this judgment should be affirmed. Consider the other three outlined earlier, which focus on looking at the case in a proper posture. This is not a case where there's been manipulation of takes by West Texas. Indeed, the more gas West Texas took, the more gas it sold, the more money it made. This is not a garden variety take or pay case, as Exxon would have the court believe. This is not a situation where there's standard language here. Section 1 is the standard language in take or pay cases. Section 4, the section at issue here, is language unique to this case. Exxon cannot cite any reported case dealing with the construction of that unusual language to fit a unique situation of a party in the middle. On the one end is Exxon, the producer, along with a number of other producers in the Emperor Field in Winkler County. On the other end is El Paso Natural Gas Lines, an interstate gas line that sends gas downstream to the ultimate consumers. But in the middle of the producers and the interstate gas line is West Texas Gathering, which gathers the gas from Exxon and all the other producers. And it pushes the gas on downstream to El Paso under a cost-plus contract. The more gas it takes, the more money it makes. And what Exxon doesn't tell you is that at the conclusion of these contracts in 1988, the line representing the gas available, that gas was still there. This is not a case about gas which was taken and not paid for. This is a case about the construction of proper language to determine how much, if any, should be paid for gas not taken that was left in the ground at the conclusion of the contract. And in that posture, these respondents initially argue that the correct construction of the contracts require affirmance. These contracts are unambiguous because they have a single, definite legal meaning. This is the test enunciated by this court on many occasions, such as 1980 in the R&P Enterprises case. Under that test, the court is to look at the language of the contract, and if from the language the intent of the parties can be ascertained, then the contract is unambiguous.
Under your construction of the second paragraph of Section 4, it is possible that the take-or-pay obligation would be essentially nothing.
It can be reduced by action of what El Paso does and the market forces. Now,
well, but that's always, that's the reason for a take-or-pay provision, isn't it?
That's the reason for the standard take-or-pay.
Well, and this in essence, is a complete act of the take-or-pay obligation.
No, Justice Heck, it is not. As explained by Steve Towns, the expert for West Texas, that if there's no governmental regulations to defend, he calculated that the take-or-pay obligation under these contracts could be as high as $3.2 million. So the difference is what was due. And the answer to that must come from a proper construction.
Well, do you concede owing $3.2 million?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that is his opinion was an incomplete statement. He wasn't attempting to predict the result of the jury, but merely to say it could be as high as this if other factors didn't come into play.
In essence, it is possible by taking less than you nominate to reduce the amount of the take-or-pay obligation by the second paragraph dramatically.
That is the effect of market forces and this language.
How can you, in good faith, nominate month after month a larger amount of gas than you take?
The record doesn't show that. In fact,
but
that's
the only way for this provision to operate that way. How could that be done? Doesn't the second paragraph assume that you will take what you nominate, because how else could you do it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. What it does, and in order to explain that, let's look at the language reduced to its simplest terms. The court has been handed the same language that you see on the chart, but this language is extensive. The second page of the handout you've been provided combines and shortens Section 1 and 4 by eliminating the necessary words, incorporating the 80% deliverability of Section 1 into Section 4, and using specific names instead of generic names. And notice what is accomplished, what is clearly accomplished by the language here. It's reduced to two simple sentences. When gas is subject to allocation by the Railroad Commission, as is true in this case, based on nominations, and West Texas has nominated at least 80% of deliverability, the minimum gas West Texas is obligated to take or pay for shall be the lesser of the allowables determined by the Railroad Commission or 80% of deliverability. This is a determination made by the Railroad Commission and it's a simple lesser of. Then comes the variable in this second paragraph. In the event West Texas nominations are less than 80%, West Texas minimum obligation shall be that gas which would have been its obligation if it had nominated 80%. All that's done is to take the Railroad Commission's calculation for the past year, but this is a retrospective calculation, is to take that calculation that exists and has been done based on actual nominations and actual takes and change one variable. That's all it says. Change the variable of whatever the nomination less than 80% was, plug in 80% and redo it.
But you can't nominate more than you take without lying, unless you're making a mistake.
But that's not the problem here. Exxon is not accusing us of nominating high and taking low.
No, but the calculation presumes that you do that.
Yes, but that doesn't violate the law because it's a hypothetical calculation to compute take or pay.
I thought your suggestion was that this contract doesn't provide for hypothetical
No, it does use a hypothetical calculation. This does use a hypothetical calculation. Looking back at what the Railroad Commission had done for the last year, and taking that completed calculation, instead of using the nomination that had actually been used of less than 80%, plugging in 80% and simply redoing the calculation. Nothing needs to be implied. Nothing is missing. But contrast that with the position of Exxon. In order for Exxon's supposed construction to work and its claim of ambiguity to be present, Exxon must add words. And the words it must add are these. These are the words that must be added to the end of the contract. Not only must it be assumed that it nominated 80%, but it must be assumed and if West Texas had taken gas equal to the nomination. So not only must that language be added, but notice something else. Exxon assumes that the takes will be 80%. Why? Why did Exxon assume it would be 100% or 10%? Well, Donnie Rosen explained that. What he was attempting to do with his nomination, his construction of the contract, was to take this computation from this level back to Section 1 and always guarantee 80%. What Donnie Rosen's construction does by saying, assume nominations of 80%, assume takes of 80%, is simply to read out as part of the contract. And
assuming that the minds met at some point.
Your Honor?
Assuming that the minds of these parties met at some point, which is hard to assume, why would Exxon put this second paragraph in there if the effect of it was essentially to vitiate the take-or-pay obligation?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it doesn't totally vitiate it. It does reduce it. But notice what the effect of Section 4 is. Section 1 is a ceiling. The take-or-pay obligation can never exceed 80%. Section 4 always contemplates, in one way or the other, that it will be less than 80%. So the parties contemplate it would be less than 80%. Exxon is referred to the negotiations. Now, what's important to keep in mind here is that this record reflects that Humble and West Texas borrowed language from El Paso contract and used it here for the purpose of trying to provide some protection to the producer. But notice that the only factor over which West Texas had any control was nominations. And when it nominated what it thought it was going to take in the next month, it had done all it could do. But if it nominated...
You had the right to take.
Yes, but if it nominated too low, then this corrected the low nomination. So the only factor over which West Texas had any control was the amount of nominations. So this contract helped control the only factor over which West Texas, being in the middle, had any control whatsoever.
You have litigation pending against the so-called other end, El Paso?
No, Your Honor.
This dispute?
This record reflects that a third-party action against El Paso Natural Gas was settled. It's not before the court. It in no way involves the decision to be made today.
Mr. Hunt, the jury heard conflicting expert testimony regarding damage calculations based on conflicting interpretations of this contract.
Correct.
And Exxon pled ambiguity, at least in the alternative.
Correct.
And submitted a broad form issue that did not instruct the jury about ambiguity.
Correct.
Your client didn't object.
All that's true.
Why shouldn't it be deemed in the judgment be finding of ambiguity be deemed in favor of the judgment, trial court judgment?
It's because of what this court wrote in Island Recreational against Republic. There, this court considered a broad form submission of a contract issue where offense and defense was submitted. But this court wrote that the test of whether broad form in exactly the same scenario that's present here. The test of whether that accurately submits offense and defense fairly is the totality of the trial proceedings. The totality of the trial proceedings indicated in Island Recreational that the trial court and the parties were all aware that offense and defense was being submitted in one broad question. But notice the difference here. The totality points the other way. Look at Exxon's objection to jury question one. Exxon's trial counsel objected to jury question one on the basis that there were no fact issues to be decided. What Exxon's counsel explained in response to jury question one was that one expert says the damages are this much, one expert says the damages are this much, therefore there's no need to inquire as to whether West Texas failed to take the minimum quantity required by the contract. See, that very language, required by the contract, tells the jury to focus on the words of the contract. And Exxon didn't even believe jury question one submitted ambiguity because it was saying no disputed issues of fact to be decided. There's a breach. But that's not all of it. This trial court and Exxon knew how to submit a question of ambiguity. And it's not just that is the contract ambiguous. That would be permitting the jury to determine the presence or absence of ambiguity. That's a question of law for the court. What must be submitted is the intent of the parties. What did the parties agree to? Now, in this charge, in jury question 4 and 5, there was a claim of ambiguity with respect to two guarantee contracts. Exxon was asserting that one of those contracts was ambiguous. So the trial court submitted jury question 4 and 5 and inquired whether the parties intended for the guarantee agreements to cover the take-or-pay obligation, and did so with instructions that permitted the jury to look at how the parties acted, how they construed it, the surrounding circumstances, the typical language that is used for determining intent of the parties. So this court and Exxon knew how to submit jury questions based on the intent of the parties to resolve a question of ambiguity. Understand, what happened here is that jury question one is a submission of breach. Exxon recognized that. But there's still a third totality that makes a difference. This jury question one was submitted in the way that pattern jury charges said submit breach. It was not submitted in the way that pattern jury charges said submit what are the parties agreed to and instructions for how to resolve ambiguity. So the complete answer is this is not a Rule 278 problem at all. This is not a case where there was any duty on the respondent defendants to change the instructions or to change the question. These respondents were satisfied with jury question one because it properly submitted a liability issue.
Well, if questions one and two are correct, though, and if you're satisfied with them, don't the answers presume that the jury did not buy your construction of the contract?
No, Your Honor.
How could they find the way they did and have accepted your view of the contract?
They couldn't. But what it shows is they accepted three different constructions, and that's another totality that illustrates why this jury didn't believe it was determining ambiguity. After all, jury questions 4 and 5 focused the jury's attention on determining ambiguity, but 1 and 2 didn't. So under the totality of the trial proceedings and this court's reasoning in Island Recreational, these two jury questions never submitted ambiguity. And for that second additional reason, there has been under Rule 279 a complete waiver of the only theory of recovery urged by West Texas, urged by Exxon on appeal. But if the court is troubled by any of that, there's a third basis in addition to the governmental regulations defense. There's a third basis for affirming this judgment, and that is because the expert testimony of Donnie Rhodes was correctly excluded. Rule 160.
At the time that Mr. Rhodes testified, you had all of his calculations. You deposed him twice. 30 days before trial, you had apparently the interrogatory answer of expert of Exxon saying that they wanted him to proceed with the calculation. He'd been deposed in September saying how he would calculate it under Method 3, and he'd given you a total amount of damages that was actually more under Method 1 than under Method 3. What more could you want?
Your Honor, this is one more we could have wanted. A 210-page document that changed the damage theory of the case 4 days before trial. Now, this particular document, however, is not the one that was presented on October 31st, 4 days before trial. This is the one that was presented 12 hours before trial. Now, notice the third page of the handout. This is a sample page, the computer printout of those 210 pages, espousing the substance of Donnie Rhodes' testimony. Look at the details shown on this handout. That 210 pages of that massive amount of detail, which was introduced into trial on the third day, was presented to two of the defendants 12 hours before trial, and two of the defendants in the middle of trial.
Can you refresh our memories as to what your trial counsel did to ask the trial court for some assistance, either by excluding that testimony or granting a continuance or some other relief?
Which trial counsel, Exxon or West Texas? West Texas.
Your client. Did trial counsel for West Texas ask the court to continue the case or to exclude the testimony for any other kind of relief based on this 200-page surprise you got the day before trial?
West Texas, Cabot, and the Mesa companies objected. That's all shown on pages 273 to 278 of the statement of facts. We did not move for a continuance, because the rules don't place any duty on us to move for continuance. What's interesting is your language, Justice Heck, where you talked about an Alvarado, the possibility of the trial court using a continuance.
The court's language.
Pardon?
The court's language.
Yes, the court's language. That language, however, didn't place the duty on the party that had been wrong. There is nothing in the rules that require that the party who believes that there's been a change in damage theory at the last minute must seek a continuance.
Well, it helps us to assess the sincerity of the objection, perhaps, of how vociferous you are at that stage, because both sides have these champions on both sides, expert witnesses, and in a complex case like this, isn't it fair for us to assume that that each side is going to try to obtain as much advantage as they can in the presentation of expert testimony and developing damage theories all the way up until the time the words come out of the expert's mouth?
Your question really goes to harm, and the harm here is explained in the language of Sharp against Broadway National. Party is entitled to go to trial assured by what he's been told and answered the interrogatories 30 days before.
Mr. Hunt, before you move on to your next point, how do you respond to Exxon's argument that the Court of Appeals committed error in rendering judgment because even by your own expert testimony, there were damages from your experts of at least $3 million damages, so the judgment could not have been rendered?
There's at least three answers to that. One I discussed with Justice Doggett, and that's the governmental regulations defense. The second is the complete waiver of the ambiguity cause of action. And the third is the correct construction of the contract doesn't get you into damages, doesn't get you into the amount of it, because Exxon never presented any damage testimony that complied with that correct construction. But let me return to an earlier comment you made, Justice Doggett, as it related to notice to these defendants and what Tim Vick said on page, as denominated in the brief on page 278. Now, these defendants never had notice that there would be a Section 4 damage study until October 31. 4 days before trial started. what Rhodes said in his deposition on September 21 in response to cross-examination is simply that if he did a damage study under 4, if he was able to do it, he would assume 80% nominations and 80% takes. That's his methodology that he revealed, and he came up with a, he thought would be a $28 million figure because it matched Section 1.
Your time's up. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I had a question I wanted to ask. Why, let's assume that the Railroad Commission wouldn't permit a gas seller or gas purchaser to nominate a whole bunch of gas and then only take a little bit of gas time after time.
That's correct.
Let's assume that's the case. Why doesn't that make that paragraph, as you wish it to be considered, meaningless? Since it's an impossible circumstance, you could not nominate 80% month after month and take 5% month after month. That would render that meaningless unless you assumed that you complied with business practices and took somewhat close to what you nominated time after time. Since you say that's not in the contract, why wouldn't we just throw out that last paragraph? Because that's one of the interpretive processes you go through to make a contract mean what the party's meant it to say. Throw that paragraph out, and you just deal with it without that.
You only do that after the court has determined that it's ambiguous. Look first at the language and see if it's clear and has meaning and purpose. Here it's clear and has meaning and purpose.
What's its meaning and purpose?
This is to control the situation where at least 80% or more has been nominated and to require the take-or-pay obligation to be the lesser of the 80% of the allowance.
And why doesn't Section 1 control the circumstance if the nomination is less than 80%? Why
would it? Section 1 only deals with unregulated fields. Notice the language beginning Section 4. During any year when the production of gas and seller property subject to allocation, and that's clear here. And the Exxon admits that Section 1 doesn't.
Of course, that's
control.
The problem. If it's, that's the only circumstance in regulated field is that the purchaser would by regulation not be permitted to buy 80% of the deliverable gas by regulation. So Section 4 protects the purchaser in the event that the Regulatory Commission doesn't permit them to buy.
Correct.
But if the Regulatory Commission would permit them to buy, then this last paragraph is immaterial because it would be tantamount to being unregulated. So your Section 1 would cover that circumstance.
No, Your Honor, it would not. See, this controls in those situations as occurred in this case. When the market went to the dickens, El Paso wasn't taking, West Texas couldn't do anything with the gas. West Texas desired to take it because the more it took, the more it made. And under this scenario, the one thing over which West Texas had some control, nominations, that control, to the extent it could nominate less than 80%, was taken away from it and the calculation redone. And when that calculation is redone, it could well produce some figure of take-or-pay liability. But you see, Your Honor, perhaps the best question to you is to look at Defendant's Exhibit 1314, two memorandum from Exxon's own records, in which one in April 1, 1986, Exxon admits that this calculation appears to be an error on its part. Then there's another memorandum dated March 30, 1984, in which Exxon admits that the way that this works is to look back at what the Railroad Commission had done for 12 years and then recalculate with only the nomination pumped up to 80%. This is not some late arriving construction. Rather, it is a construction which is found in the corporate records of Exxon. But nowhere in those corporate records of Exxon will there be found any reference to this change of construction that it adopted 3 weeks before trial.
Well, I'm not sure if you were finished on Mr. Rhodes when you got that last question, but I know I wasn't. And let me ask you, the method that he indicated he would use under under, or the approach that he would use under Method 3 that he told you about in September, whether it was right or wrong, that's the approach he ended up using at the time of trial, isn't it?
Correct.
And you had that in September, and you had also in September Exxon's indication in their interrogatory answer that if it could be figured out, they planned to use Method 3 at the time of trial.
They said it, the calculations will be done.
Right.
And we may use it. That tells we may not use it, too.
Well, they had that right, didn't they?
Sure, they could try it alternatively. But if they want to try an alternative and have two experts or an expert with two different opinions, the substance of both of those opinions must be given 30 days in advance.
The report that you showed me when I asked about Mr. Rhodes previously, that represented a change in his testimony from 23 point something million to 25 million?
The October 31 was 23 million. This that was introduced in the trial was 25 million. But that's not the change we're complaining about. That's immaterial. But you see, Exxon got on the Section 1 damage horse, told us in answer to interrogatories on September 21, 60 days before trial, that it intended that the methodology used by Mr. Rhodes in his July report of 1990 was accurate and that it had not made up its mind whether it would use any other damage theory. It made up its mind 3 weeks before trial. Now, in contrast to what has been stated here today about Mr. Vick and telling us, look at page 278. That's not Mr. Vick testifying. That's counsel for Exxon answering to the objection of West Texas. He refers to the Vick deposition of October the 9th and says that Mr. Vick told us that these calculations will be done. But first, that's still within the 30 days. But happily, the court doesn't have to rely on what counsel just said of his recollection of Mr. Vick's testimony. Because on pages 597 and 598 of this record, Mr. Vick, a witness under oath, is cross-examined about what he said in his deposition. There, he was forced to admit that in his deposition on October the 9th, he never took the position that there had to be takes equal to nominations. So it would have been impossible for Vic to have told us on that date that Exxon was going to use this late-breaking damage theory. Exxon got on a damage horse on Section 1. It abandoned that damage horse 3 weeks before trial without telling anybody. 4 days before trial, it brought a first inaccurate report. 12 hours before trial, it gave the final report that increased the inaccurate reports some 2 million damages.
Is there any question that those two reports, of which I take page 3 of our handout is from, were consistent with the theory that takes would be equal to 80% nominations?
No. The problem, of course, is it's not enough to just know that a theory may be done when a party changes damage theories after having answered in response to interrogatories that it had no such calculations, that it didn't know whether it would do those calculations.
But there's no complaint that some well in here is figured wrong.
No. There are inaccuracies, and some challenges may be made to that. The problem is that we're not very well prepared to challenge these things. When you get it, when one party gets it 12 hours before trial, and two other parties get it in the middle of trial, how in the world can trial counsel get its expert prepared to respond to this?
Thank you.
That's the difficulty. Exxon has made its bed, it should lie in.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court is now ready to hear argument on rebuttal.
Mr. Ratliff, does the position that Exxon's trial counsel took in the charge conference regarding issue number one, as described by your opposing counsel, indicate that there's no ambiguity here?
No, Your Honor,
Exxon's position?
I think that as a matter of fact, I'll be honest, Your Honor. I'll have to go back and even look. I don't remember that. I wasn't in the charge conference, so I don't recall. I'll certainly look at it. But the fact of the matter was, it was made clear by that trial judge that the question of how this contract, how it was going to be calculated, it was going to the jury. And whether we made that objection or not, it was overruled. And this is what the trial judge did. And so I will go back and look, though, Your Honor, to determine it. I just simply don't have that on the top of my head. Let me see if I can very briefly go back over some things that I think counsel said that I think are quite interesting. One, he says, West Texas is just the middleman. I would remind the court here, every pipeline is just a middleman. They are people who purchase gas at one end of the line and they sell it at the other. Now, the fact of the matter is, whatever deal they had with El Paso was their deal with El Paso. It wasn't Exxon. He made another interesting point in connection with some of Justice Heck's questions and I think Justice Enoch's question, and that is, he said, look, what we're seeing here is the effect of market forces. That's exactly what Universal Resources and Hammond say that a take-or-pay clause is supposed to do. It shifts the risk of market forces onto the purchaser of gas and protects the producer who has their gas tied up and can't sell it to anybody else. It protects the producer and gives that producer at least some relief in the form of cash flow. And when counsel says that this is somehow an unusual contract, that is both standard take-or-pay. It is what the Texas courts have recognized as standard take-or-pay. If you read the Hammond decision, it goes through every one of those factors.
But Section 4 is a...
Section 4 is unusual. I think it's interesting that counsel points to the court, the Clemmer to Hakey memo and the Terrio to Clemmer memo. Those were both post-execution memorandum by engineers at Exxon. Why isn't it a little more important to go back to Mr. Sledge, who was the one who drafted the language? He and Jimmy Cole, who was the vice president of West Texas, came up with it. Everybody agrees it was to protect the producer. Go back and look at that, because I believe, under the case law, that that is a surrounding circumstance. We had a point in which the person who negotiated the 77 deal on behalf of Exxon said, I considered the way they had interpreted the language under the earlier contract that required this recalculation in what I figured we were agreeing on in this agreement. And he never had any problem as long as Mr. Cole was running West Texas. Now, the fact of the matter is that counsel says that we still have the reserves. Universal Resources, which was a Fifth Circuit case that was decided under Texas law, says that if the pipeline company makes that deal, and if those reserves are still there at the end of the period of time, they still bargain for the or-pay portion of the obligation during the time period of the contract. And that the fact that the pipeline was unable to take the gas during the continuance of the contract, they have a makeup right during the time that the contract continues. If they're unable to do it, that was the term of the bargain, and I think it's represented by the cases. Now, counsel goes on at some length about our interpretation of paragraph 2, and he comes up with his very simplified version. I will submit that if you use the method they calculate by, it is a very simple method. And that says, West Texas Gathering Company shall be liable to Exxon for that quantity of gas which it elects to take and pay for. You don't need all this other language. Now, the fact of the matter is, he did say that Mr. Towns had computed $3.2 million in damages as an alternative measure. He correctly points out that West Texas never agreed that that was an amount due. It is important to note that the way Mr. Towns did his calculations, he did those calculations on the basis of a
find the actual Railroad Commission allowable, assigned to this field, based on West Texas nominations. And then all he did was raise the nomination. Mr. Towns also testified that while they...
Well, you may have answered my question just then, just for my clarification. To accept West Texas' understanding of this agreement, that second paragraph of Section 4 seems to me that you all would have to calculate, had the nomination been 80%,
right,
then you would have to speculate as to what the Railroad Commission allowable would have been based upon its track record of takes. And West Texas takes the position that that is a calculable figure, that there would have been some figure arrived at other than simply, well, last month they took 5% and this month they're nominating 8%, and the Railroad Commission would have allowed something between 80% and 5%, and that could have been calculated.
What they really would have done, Your Honor, under the allowable system, is they would have taken the 80% nomination for the coming month. They would have looked back 3 months and seen that West Texas was only taking 5% while nominating 80%. They then would subtract the volume differential between 80% and 5% and reduce whatever allowable was assigned to Exxon in this field. They would reduce it by that amount. Now, as Mr. Towns said, once they caused that...
Would that mean that the allowable would be equal to the last 3 months of take? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's important to look at the record, and we've got it cited in the brief where Mr. Towns said that the practical matter, under his, the method that he uses, takes will drive the allowable, and if West Texas takes zero, the allowable will be zero. And that is the reason that the level of those takes is critical. What the differential between nominations and takes does is it causes a precipitous decline in the allowable. But once you get down to the level of takes, takes are what are driving the allowable system. And their own witness agreed with that. If I could, let me move briefly to the question of Mr. Rhodes. First of all, I would invite the court's attention to the materials that you handed out to the court, and under tab 6, we have a time sequence relating to Rhodes' methodology and testimony starting in July and going through November when the verdict was rendered. That time sequence, and also Mr. Justice Doggett, the record citations to the statement of facts and the transcript testimony for Mr. Vick, are noted. You will note in that Mr. Rhodes was examined on the methodology of paragraph 2 of section 4 for 4 days in September. You will also, I think, note, if you will look at plaintiff's exhibit number 22, when counsel starts talking about they were presented with a whole new study on the night before trial, they were presented with a report that had mathematical errors corrected and an errata sheet that said this was the correction that was made and this is the reason for the correction. And they were math errors, but as Mr. Towns testified, in a recalculating allowable, if you change one number, it has a domino effect and it changes a lot of numbers. But we gave them an errata sheet. There was no change in methodology, and that simply is a red herring.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.